You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Everything's Coming Up Priyanka by Rebecca Ford. But I sense a push and pull in Priyanka that seems new to her. She's close to capturing the Hollywood career she's always dreamed of. But, like many women at the top of their field who have chosen to prioritize their mental health, she clearly doesn't want to spend all of 2022 grinding herself into the ground, or being alone in an empty London apartment, working nights. "I've always been such a worker bee," she says. "My priority has always been the next job. I'm a very, very ambitious person. But I think the woman in me is craving balance. I'm craving my family life. I'm craving being able to do things for the soul that I didn't do because I was just blinders on and working." Priyanka admits that her path has left her with some bruises and scars. "I think maybe that's why I'm becoming a lot more introverted as I go along on this journey in the entertainment business now," she tells me. "I'm starting to protect myself a lot more because I realize how much it takes out of you. It takes a part of your soul, constantly trying to make sure that you say the right thing, do the right thing, dress the right way, not make a mistake, not trip because the whole world is going to watch. Or not fall when you're walking up on a red carpet or say something wrong or have a bad effing day." Priyanka knows 2022 is going to bring change. "I feel like I am at a precipice of reinvention," she says. "What is the new me? I'm very excited about the future. I'm terrified of it, too. Change is always scary, but I've done it multiple times in my life." This time, she intends to care for herself as much as she does for her career. "When does this article come out?" she asks as our time wraps up. I tell her that it's the February issue. "That's what I want to do. By the time this piece comes out, that's what I will be doing." I believe her. Music Man. Hugh Jackman is returning to Broadway in one of its most beloved musicals. Michael Rydell goes behind the curtain to reveal how the industry's next big hope survived charges of obsolescence, Scott Rudin's downfall, and COVID-19. With photographs by Annie Leibovitz, styled by Michael Fisher. Opening photo, The Boy from Oz. Hugh Jackman shows off his athleticism in New York City's Canal Park. In February 2020, Hugh Jackman and Sutton Foster, a two-time Tony Award winner, began work on a splashy Broadway revival of The Music Man. Produced by Scott Rudin, then Broadway's most powerful and prolific impresario, and directed by Jerry Zaks, the production was shaping up to be the event of the fall theater season. When tickets went on sale, the advance soared to $30 million. Rehearsals that February were intimate. Just Jackman, Foster, Warren Carlyle, the show's choreographer, and a few people from the music department. Rudin popped in from time to time, as did Zaks. Jackman and Foster had never worked together. The goal was to develop the chemistry between Jackman's Professor Harold Hill, the charismatic flim-flam salesman of musical instruments, and Foster's Marion Peru, the guarded but discerning town librarian, Marion the Librarian, as the show's creator, Meredith Wilson, had called her. By the end of 4 weeks, the chemistry was there. Confidence in the room was high. And then, early on the morning of February 28th, Jackman woke up and could not breathe. It was, he remembered, the first time in his life that he thought, "If I wake up tomorrow morning and I'm sicker than this, I think I'm going to go to the hospital." I thought, shit. Carlyle arose that day, coughing and feverish, but was determined, he says, to drag myself to rehearsals. Foster had a temperature of 104 degrees, a bad cough, and an inability to taste or smell. She decided to call in sick. But when she checked her phone, Jackman had already done the same. "Hugh canceled," Carlyle said. "He has never canceled." Jackman, Foster, and Carlyle all think they had come down with COVID-19, though tests were scarce back then. 2 weeks later, on March 12th, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo shut down Broadway. A bunch of theater producers gathered at Sardi's that night to commiserate. One of them had a cough. A few days later, many of them, including Rudin, came down with COVID. Jackman had flown to Australia that same day to meet up with his wife, Deborah Lee Furness. He got a frantic call from his lawyer telling him to get on the next plane to New York because there was talk of closing the borders. Rehearsals for The Music Man were to start again in July. If he were stuck abroad, he could be in breach of contract. Jackman and Furness returned to New York on March 19th to a ghost town, he said. Rehearsals did not start in July. Broadway, in fact, shut down for 18 months, destroying the livelihoods of thousands of actors, stagehands, ushers, restaurant staff, parking garage attendants, and others connected to the theatrical trade. The $2 billion that Broadway annually poured into New York City's coffers evaporated. But The Music Man, defying the pandemic, has survived. On February 10th, it was scheduled to open at the Winter Garden Theater, where the marquee has been up for more than a year, its advance now $35 million in the bank. Broadway's return last fall was spotty. Disney's Aladdin opened, then had to shut for 2 weeks after a COVID outbreak among cast and crew. Ticket sales for all but a few shows were weak, with international tourism, Broadway's trough for years, having dried up. There's a sense on the street that Broadway's real return won't come until late winter or early spring, just around the time that Jackman, the biggest box office draw in the business, will be leading a cast of 45 actors employed for the first time in a long time in 76 trombones. Jackman and the Music Man go back a long way. He auditioned for the show in high school. He memorized the opening number, Rock Island, better known from its lyrics as "But He Doesn't Know the Territory," and got the part of salesman number two. Another student, David Anderson, landed the lead. "He was really good," Jackman said of Anderson. But envy was in Jackman's eyes. One day, damn it, he thought, that part could be his. Jackman lost touch with Anderson, but David, if you're reading this, Jackman says he'll leave two tickets under your name at the box office. Jackman's chance to play Harold Hill came in 2018 when Rudin offered him the role. Jackman's friend, Barbara Cook, Marion in the original 1957 production, had long encouraged him to do the show. To have a successful Music Man, you have to have a Harold Hill all the women in town want to F, and half the men want to F too, she told him. But Jackman was indecisive, he recalled. He wanted to do an original musical, not a revival. So he passed. A year later, with no original musical in development, he changed his mind. He was 51. He knew he wouldn't have the stamina to tackle the physically demanding part of Harold Hill much longer. "It's time," he told his agent. They rang Rudin. But there was a problem. A British producer now had the rights and was planning a London production. "Let me look into it," Rudin said. Jackman went to a corner of his apartment, sat down, put his head in his hands, and thought, "You're an idiot. It's gone. It won't be done for another 10 years. "I was really down," he said. Rudin called back the next day. "It's done," he said. "It's yours." That was the Rudin magic. Nothing stood in his way. His taste was impeccable, his ability to land major stars unrivaled. His string of Broadway hits included The Book of Mormon, Hello, Dolly, and To Kill a Mockingbird, adapted for the stage by Aaron Sorkin. Rudin oversaw every aspect of his productions, script development, marketing, advertising, right down to seating arrangements on opening night. He was also as tough as they come and never shrank from a fight. He got into a nasty lawsuit with Stephen Sondheim over the rights to Sondheim's musical Gold, in which Rudin had been an early investor. He battled Harper Lee's estate when it objected to Sorkin's portrayal of Atticus Finch as a one-time racist. Both lawsuits were settled out of court. Rudin had recently formed a production company with his two friends, Barry Diller, the chairman of IAC, and David Geffen, one of the founders of DreamWorks. They would put up the money for the Music Man. Jackman was in good hands. Jackman never aspired to be a musical theater star. At drama school in Australia, he studied Shakespeare. When he graduated, he landed a part in a TV series. He thought he'd make his living in television and, one day, the movies. But then his agent sent him in for the role of Gaston in the Australian production of Beauty and the Beast. He wasn't much of a singer, but he got the part, though Disney insisted he take singing lessons once a week. When Beauty and the Beast closed, he auditioned for the role of Joe Gillis, the cynical screenwriter, for the Melbourne production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Sunset Boulevard. He didn't want to be pigeonholed as a musical theater performer, but he couldn't resist meeting the show's director, Trevor Nunn, who led the Royal Shakespeare Company in the 1970s and went on to stage Cats and Les Miserables. At the audition, Nunn told him to pretend he was singing to a young, idealistic Joe Gillis, who detest what he's become. It was a nifty bit of direction, Jackman thought. After the audition, he called his agent and said, "If this guy offers me the part, I'm in." Nunn, meanwhile, told his assistants, "I don't need to see anybody else." Jackman's run in Sunset Boulevard was cut short in 1997 when Lloyd Webber, his company, then on shaky financial ground, shut down every production of the show. But Jackman and Nunn kept in touch. A year later, when Jackman was in London, he called Nunn, who was about to take over the Royal National Theatre and was planning his first season, which included a revival of Oklahoma. Nunn told Jackman to come round for an audition. "Just bring a Shakespeare and sing a song from Oklahoma," Nunn said. Jackman met with Nunn and four associate directors of the theater. He performed a Shakespeare monologue, and the directors immediately started debating what it meant, as if they were in graduate school. When he sang, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning," the director sang along. Jackman left the meeting puzzled. "I definitely got this gig," he thought, "or I've completely screwed this up, and this is the worst audition of my life." "The audition was phony," Nunn would later recall with a laugh. "I'd already cast him as Curly. He just wanted to make sure the other directors were on board." A major discovery is what one London critic, echoing his colleagues, called Jackman. Unfortunately for Nunn, in his view, about 20 Hollywood film producers thought the same, and all the wonderful things I was hoping to do with you were whisked away. The next year, the elusive movie career Jackman had been trying to pursue kicked in after he landed his breakthrough role, Wolverine, in X-Men. The film went on to gross nearly $300 million worldwide. Before X-Men, Jackman had been offered the part of Peter Allen, the flamboyant, bisexual Australian songwriter and performer, in a musical based on Allen's life called The Boy from Oz. Jackman knew it was a good role, but turned it down, fearing, yet again, he'd be pigeonholed in musical theater. But when he saw the show in Sydney, starring a very capable Todd McKinney, his heart sank. He'd made a big mistake. It wasn't just a good part. It was the perfect part for him. A few years later, as he was reading the script for the second X-Men movie, he got a call from the producers of The Boy from Oz. They were taking the show to Broadway. They wanted him to play Peter Allen. This time, he grabbed it. His agent had doubts. Jackman's movie career was taking off. Now was the time to cement his relationship with the studios. But Jackman wasn't about to watch someone else's name appear on the marquee. "I can't go through that again," he told his agent. The Boy from Oz opened on Broadway on October 16, 2003. "The critics adored Jackman, a rising movie star," said one, but dismissed the show as a by-the-numbers bio-musical that, in the words of the New York Times, settles for a staleness and hollowness that even Mr. Jackman's blazing presence can't disguise. The producers promised to keep the show running through Christmas. After that, all bets were off. A rising movie star did not guarantee strong ticket sales in January and February. Jackman was deflated. Then, one night that October, he noticed that many of the men in the audience were paying more attention to their Blackberries than the show. It dawned on him that they were checking the score of the Yankees-Marlins World Series. Jackman had a line. "I know what you're thinking. Is he or isn't he? It's true. I'm Australian." That night, he changed it to, "I know what you're thinking. What's the score on the baseball?" People looked up from their handheld devices. Jackman ran off stage to get the score from the TV set in his dressing room. He came back on and announced it to cheers from the audience. For the rest of the night, he provided World Series updates. The audience loved it, and so did Jackman. Peter Allen had always bantered with his audience, so why shouldn't he? Jackman started poking fun at latecomers. Next photo, Broadway royalty. Jackman and co-star Sutton Foster rehearse at Gibney Dance, New York. He stole that bit of making fun of latecomers from fellow Australian Dame Edna. "Take your time, sweetheart," he'd say, always in character. "Not much has happened, trust me. Do you want me to sing the first song again?" Everybody thought Jackman's ad-libs lifted the show. Well, not everybody. One of the creators wrote Jackman a letter berating him for departing from the text. Jackman ignored it. Pretty soon, he was bringing people on stage to dance with him. On one occasion, he tried to get a reluctant man to stand up and dance. The man wouldn't budge. "Okay, you sit. Everybody else stand." They did. Sometimes, he admitted, he got carried away. A woman once yelled, "I want to bite your ass." "Come on up and do it," he replied. She did, and left a bruise. Word got around town. That stale bio musical was a hoot, and all because of Jackman. The box office exploded. Women went wild, mobbing him at the stage door. Celebrities flocked to the show. Barbara Cook saw it 12 times. Jackman gave Barbara Walters a lap dance on stage. Steven Spielberg told him he should host the Tonys. He did, and drove up ratings. The last 3 months of the run were sold out, with scalpers getting huge markups for what was no longer being called The Boy from Oz. It was now known as The Hugh Jackman Show. Jackman left after a year, no longer just a rising movie star, but a gold-plated Broadway sensation. In 2011, Jackman, now a big movie star, had an idea about doing a one-man music and dance show. He and his friend Warren Carlyle, who had been in the Chorus of Oklahoma and was now a choreographer, went to work on the stage of the Curran Theater in San Francisco. It was just the two of them. "We were like, well, what songs do you like? What do you want to do?" Carlyle recalled. "That's how we built it." The show roared into New York on an advance of $10 million. Scalpers were getting $1,500 for orchestra seats. One day, Jackman was walking to the theater. A scruffy-looking man came up to him and said, "I've got tickets for Hugh Jackman tonight." Jackman lowered his sunglasses and said, "I am Hugh Jackman, mate." By the end of its 10-week run, Hugh Jackman, back on Broadway, had grossed nearly $15 million. When COVID shut down New York that bleak March, Jackman, masked and gloved, walked his dog and made runs to the local grocery store. Carlyle holed up in his apartment on the Upper West Side and walked his dog, too. "The poor dog is exhausted," he said. Foster retreated to her weekend house in upstate New York, sat on her couch, drank wine, and watched movies. She was eager to return to Broadway after a 6-year absence, during which she'd starred in the TV Land series Younger. She'd burst on the scene in 2002, when she'd taken over the leading role in Thoroughly Modern Millie, after the original star left due to creative differences with the director. She won the Tony for Best Actress in a Musical. In 2011, she picked up a second Tony as Reno Sweeney in a revival of Anything Goes. She was a Broadway A-lister, but she still had to audition for Marian the Librarian. She was intimidated, and not just because Jackman was in the room. Marian is typically played by a soprano, and some of the notes are a bit high for her range. The music director arranged the songs "Till There Was You," "Goodnight, My Someone," and "My White Knight" in her key. After she finished singing, Zax stood up and said, "Okay, we want you to do it." "I was a flutter," she remembered. Zax was putting the finishing touches on the musical adaptation of Mrs. Doubtfire when the producer came to the theater on March 12th and told everyone that Broadway was shutting down. Zax, terrified of COVID, he said, decamped to Belport, New York, and read But He Doesn't Know the Territory, Meredith Willson's charming memoir of the making of The Music Man. Zax read it 5 times. "It's my Bible," he said. Wilson spent 6 years, 1950 to 1956, writing The Music Man. He based it on his memories of his idyllic childhood in Mason City, Iowa. He created Harold Hill, the phony band leader, because he'd been a musician all his life. He played the piccolo in John Philip Sousa's band and the flute for the New York Philharmonic under Arturo Toscanini. Acting out all the parts and accompanying himself on the piano, Wilson auditioned the Music Man for dozens of backers and directors. The legendary Moss Hart, director of My Fair Lady, hated it. Finally, Kermit Blumgarden, producer of Death of a Salesman, picked it up. Broadway sophisticates told him it would never work. It was, they said, old-fashioned and corny. The Music Man, starring Robert Preston and Barbara Cook, opened at the Majestic Theater in December 1957, won 5 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, beating out the groundbreaking West Side Story, and ran for almost 3.5 years. It became a staple of high school and amateur theater groups. But it was only revived once on Broadway, in 2000, directed by Susan Stroman, who went on to stage The Producers. As popular as it is, The Music Man has always been dogged by its reputation for being, as those New York sophisticates once thought, old-fashioned and corny. Sondheim and Hal Prince had transformed musical theater with sophisticated shows such as Company, Follies, and A Little Night Music. A guy in a plumed hat marching around and twirling a baton seemed a little hokey. But as Zax went through the show and plunged into Wilson's memoir, he realized something. Wilson had affection for his hometown, but the Music Man is not sentimental. Harold Hill and Marion Peru are tough people who couldn't be more convinced of the fact that they don't need to be in love, Zax said. You've got these two forces bumping up against each other. It's the best spectator sport. Watching people try to cope with avoiding connecting. It's great comedy. It's fertile air. As the COVID lockdown wore on, Foster got off the couch and took dance cardio classes over Zoom. I started training 5 times a week, she said. Jackman went into gear as well. He got a key to a rehearsal studio where he and Carlisle, wearing masks and keeping 20 feet apart, plunged into choreography for the show. I'm not a dancer, Jackman said. It's not in my bones, but I can learn it. I can get there. So I thought, having all this time, there's no way I'm going to waste it. He also was mindful of the fact that Foster had won 2 Tonys for Dancing Up a Storm. She can learn a new dance in 3 hours, and she's the best dancer you've seen on Broadway. Jackman's assessment of his dancing skills amused Carlisle. In his defense, he's extremely dexterous. You give him a cane, and he can flip a cane. You ask him to jump, and he can jump really high. I've had 24 years of trying every single possible way to embarrass and humiliate him. He's always managed to overcome and succeed. While Jackman and Carlisle were flipping canes, Rudin was on dozens of Zoom calls trying to figure out how to bring Broadway back. Other producers were paralyzed with fear, but Rudin was working like a dervish, according to a source who was in on those Zoom calls. It was the best version of Scott. Rudin pushed for federal and state grants that, in the end, helped give shows the millions of dollars they needed to reopen. And then, on April 7th, The Hollywood Reporter dropped a story titled Unhinged, detailing Rudin's abusive treatment of office assistants. Most of it wasn't new. In 2005, The Wall Street Journal had run a profile of Rudin called Bosszilla. He proudly told the journal that his management style was a cross between Attila the Hun and Miss Jean Brodie. The stories of throwing cell phones and teacups at assistants were the stuff of legend, and there was always a sense that if you could survive a year working for Rudin, you could go anywhere in show business. And, in fact, many of his former assistants did. But the THR story landed at a time when work culture had changed. Now, there was little tolerance for bullying. The article raised a pointed question. When so many people in the entertainment industry were under intense scrutiny for past behavior, how had Rudin managed to avoid the gaze? And it contained a damning anecdote. Rudin once smashed a computer monitor on an assistant's hand. The assistant ended up in the hospital. "When I read that, I knew it was over," said a producer who's worked with Rudin. The press piled on, and Rudin, once a master manipulator of reporters, found that they had him stitched up in a bag and tossed him in the river. He announced he would step back from all of his projects, including The Music Man. He has not spoken publicly since that announcement. Jackman said he was blindsided by the Rudin controversy. "I hadn't worked with Scott before, but he'd only been fantastic to me, as a friend, as a collaborator." But, Jackman added, there's no reason and no excuse for Rudin's treatment of his staff. "I certainly won't stand for it when I'm in a room." Zax said that he, too, can't excuse Rudin's behavior, yet added, "I miss him. I miss his theatrical intelligence and his taste. He makes you do your best work." Diller recalled that he shivered when Rudin announced he was leaving the show. "It's Scott's production," Diller said. "Neither he nor Geffen knew how to take the reins of a Broadway musical. It's not what we do, it's what Scott does." But Diller moved quickly to calm the waters, hiring Kate Horton, a high-powered British producer who ran the Royal Court Theatre in London, to take over the show. "Rudin has a financial interest in The Music Man, but Horton," Diller told me, "is now the boss." She declined to be interviewed. As the Rudin scandal unfolded, the Black Lives Matter movement erupted on Broadway, even with theaters dark from COVID-19. In anticipation of production's return, activists demanded pledges from Broadway executives for more diversity on stage and off. The Music Man, whose book contains some cringeworthy Native American stereotypes, they've been dropped from the revival, became a target. It sets forth a sanitized, insular, and very white America, regularly exploited by a recent president to stoke racial fears and pit Americans against one another, a culture critic wrote in the Los Angeles Times. It asks audiences to cheer for yet another romanticized fraud. That's a bit much to pour on a musical comedy from another era. But people involved in the show feared an onslaught of such attacks. A rumor raced around the theater world that Zax had cut My White Knight from the show because of the word white. The rumor was absurd. My White Knight is Marion's description of her ideal man and has nothing to do with race. But the uproar sprang from the atmosphere swirling around the show. In point of fact, Zach's revival, with some contemporary updates to its book, has a diverse cast, one-third of whom are people of color, including Emma Crowe, Nicholas Ward, Philip Boykin, and Rima Webb. As for the charge that the musical romanticizes a con man when much of America is still in the grip of Donald Trump, Stroman laughed and, quoting a line from the show, said, "Well, the con man gets his foot caught in the door. If Donald Trump got his foot caught in the door, we'd all be better off. Donald Trump never changed. Harold Hill falls in love." Harold Hill does fall in love, but until he does, the audience must believe he's out to fleece the people of River City. Both Jackman and Zax want him to have a harder edge than he's had in previous productions. "If he gets off the train in the first scene and he's happy, I'm not interested in that," Zax said. "I want to see Harold Hill get off the train and force me to imagine what he's thinking." "He's not a nice guy," said Jackman. "He's not a terrible guy. He's making a living, and he's sort of on the bottom side, probably a little rougher edge to the bottom side of things." Jackman, flashing that grin that's charmed audiences all over the world, added, "He's got to be a lot less Hugh Jackman." The house that porn built. Who torched the CEO of Pornhub's mega mansion? Adam Leif Gollner investigates a case of arson with no shortage of possible suspects. And the adult site's shadowy founders under fire from activists, evangelicals, and victims of revenge porn break their silence. Artwork by Jonathan Harris. Opening illustration, sizzle reel, a mosaic of 2,200 video clips from I Love Your Work, a 2013 project by artist and technologist Jonathan Harris that documents the everyday lives of sex workers. Shortly before midnight, on Sunday, April 25th, 2021, Pornhub co-owner Farah Santoon lay in bed sleeping when his cell phone started blowing up. The ringer on silent didn't wake him. How, in fact, did he sleep at night, knowing that Pornhub had negatively affected so many people's lives? He'd been asked that very question 2 months earlier while being harangued at a Canadian parliamentary hearing. His response was hardly contrite. "We are very sorry if this has caused any impact on victims." He went on to say, with an evidently clear conscience, how proud he was that we built a product that gets 170 million people visiting a day. Pornhub, with its undulating ocean of explicit content, is often ranked among the 10 most viewed websites in the world. More Americans use it than use Twitter, Netflix, or Instagram. As a result, in his hometown of Montreal, Antoine is known as le roi de la porno, the king of porn. And the king's castle, it turned out, was the cause of those frantic late-night calls. At the time, Antoine had been finalizing construction on a 21-room mega mansion, 11 bathrooms, 9-car garage, 6,000-square-foot ballroom and sports wing. "I was building the house of my dreams," the notoriously press-averse Antoon told me in his first interview in more than a decade. "And everything was going great." Or so it seemed. With people housebound by the pandemic in early 2020, Pornhub saw a surge in smut-surfing numbers. U.S. traffic increased by up to 41.5% in the first month of the lockdown. The brand became ubiquitous in popular culture, appearing in gags on late-night comedy shows and the business pages. Quoth Fortune, should a Pornhub buy Tumblr? But then, starting in December, a series of legal and PR scandals slammed the company. First, a New York Times expose accused the firm of knowingly hosting child sex abuse materials. CSAM. Antoon denied the charges. "Any suggestion that we allow or encourage illegal content is completely untrue and defies rational reason from both a moral and business standpoint," he told me. Still, Canadian senators and MPs called for a criminal investigation. In the uproar, credit card processors suspended payments on the site. Lawsuits proceeded on several fronts. An internal memo Antoon wrote about the company missing its year-end financial goals was leaked. Suddenly, attention shifted to his big-ass man cave. As his dream home gets close to completion, noted the Daily Mail, Antoon faces a money crunch nightmare. His empire is in danger of crumbling. On April 22nd, he placed his chateau on the market for nearly $16 million. 3 days later, a security guard monitoring surveillance footage at Pornhub parent company MindGeek's office in Montreal noticed something unusual. The CCTV feed from Antoon's uninhabited, nearly completed house showed two trespassers on the premises. Adding to the intrigue, the estate was situated right along so-called Mafia Row, a secluded road where at least a few local Cosa Nostra bosses had resided. Why there? It's a quiet street with few cars, he told me. Plus, the place was within walking distance from where he grew up. Surely, he realized that the Strip had ties to organized crime. He declined to answer. He did concede, however, that he now wishes he could erase the mansion from his memory. I want it forgotten. That said, he can't help recounting how he lay in bed that night, powerless, 2 miles from the still unfinished building, asleep, at home with his wife and children, as the company's security officer alerted 911. By the time police showed up, the Pornhub Palace was in flames. Antoon finally woke up when his brother got through on the landline. Driving over, he told me, he kept hoping it would turn out to be something small, maybe just some teenagers messing around. In reality, it took up to 80 firefighters to battle the blaze. Flames soared 150 feet skyward. Neighbors were being evacuated in their pajamas. Arriving at the scene, he recalled, I was devastated. The conflagration raged all night. It took a while to control because it was a big place, explained Caroline Chevrefi, a police officer on site that evening. As her shift ended around 6:30 a.m., the fire department was still extinguishing flare-ups. Whoever set the fire was a professional. Nobody was injured. The surrounding homes were barely damaged. Antoon's entire crib, however, was pyroed. All that remained was charred concrete, twisted metal, and a rusty two-story archway where the front door would have been. To this day, it protrudes from the rubble like a headstone or some telltale sex toy. Did Antoon have any idea who was responsible? I don't want to accuse anyone until I know the facts, he told me. Police insist the case is ongoing. Did they have any hard leads? There are no more details to reveal, Chevrefi told me, after confirming that 2 unidentified suspects were seen breaking and entering. Everyone had a theory. Some suggested Antoon had set it up to collect the insurance money, an allegation he dismissed. Others were persuaded that the livid father of an underage victim had the place burned down as revenge for homemade MPEGs uploaded onto Pornhub. Still, another faction pointed to Q-minded anti-pornography crusaders. Or, given the precision of the firebombing, wasn't it a signature mob job? Months later, Montreal police issued a bulletin about a citywide arson spree, though there was no mention of the Pornhub blaze. Whatever the cause, Antoon's inferno was searingly symbolic. It represented not just bad juju befalling the XXX site, but an overheated, inflammatory political climate in the ongoing war against online porn. Before the internet, portrayals of sex acts were the purview of adult magazines and movies. Today, hardcore sex is instantly accessible on mobile devices, social media feeds, and VR headsets. This shift in carnal consumption has had far-reaching effects, transforming sexual norms, implicating underage viewers and victims, and creating new forms of cyber-capitalist sex work. Beyond the masses watching porn, many at home also make it, and they make money doing so through sites like Antoon's. As society grapples with the implications, Pornhub has found itself at the center of a vitriolic global conversation. The next photo is of the house up in flames. 40 years ago, debates about porn focused on the idea that the sex industry was inherently dehumanizing and rife with abuse. Activist Andrea Dworkin famously argued that porn was detrimental to women, full stop. But not all second-wave feminists agreed. A vocal faction argued for an erotic positive approach to rejecting sexual repression. The phrase, "pornography is violence against women," wrote Ellen Willis, an influential pro-sex feminist, was code for the neo-Victorian idea that that men want sex and women endure it. The argument remains as contentious as it is unresolved. This fall, The Times published an op-ed by Michelle Goldberg, Why Sex-Positive Feminism is Falling Out of Fashion, citing a TikTok-based cancel porn movement. Then again, Cosmo contended that, as we all know, women enjoy porn just as much as guys do. In fact, an estimated one-third of Pornhub's users are women. And the current feminist perspective on the porn debate might best be summarized by Oxford philosopher Amiya Srinivasan in her new book, The Right to Sex, Feminism in the 21st Century. If a woman says she enjoys working in porn, or being paid to have sex with men, or engaging in rape fantasies, or wearing stilettos, and even that she doesn't just enjoy these things, but finds them emancipatory, part of her feminist praxis, then we are required, many feminists think, to trust her. This is not merely an epistemic claim. That a woman's saying something about her own experience gives us strong, if not indefeasible, reason to think is true. And questions of belief and consent, especially those involving abuse, are where Pornhub's current troubles began. The site, founded in 2007, became notorious for allegedly hosting revenge porn, in which non-consensual intimate material is uploaded by former lovers, almost always men. For years, Pornhub didn't seem to do much to help victims remove unwanted clips. Take the case of British soccer player Lee Nicol, who is suing Pornhub over a sex video it shared of her, without permission, stolen by an iCloud hacker. It ruined my life. It killed my personality. It zapped the happiness out of me, Nicol stated. I still bear those scars. Survivors like Nicol have now been ensnared in a partisan minefield, many of them inadvertently. She and the 33 other plaintiffs in her class action lawsuit are being represented by Michael Bowe, former counsel to Donald Trump, who also represented a disgraced Jerry Falwell Jr. in his recent sex scandal. Bowe's complaint accused Pornhub of being one of the largest human trafficking ventures in the world. The company responded by calling him a soldier of the ultra-right-wing effort to shut down the adult content industry. It isn't only the right that has taken up this fight. Many prominent liberal voices have chimed in, too. But the left, as usual, is divided. Centrists want regulatory oversight. Many progressives insist on the importance of heeding the needs of sex workers. They are opposed by, among others, those with sex worker exclusionary radical politics. Still, the most vehement anti-porn and anti-Pornhub voices are those on the fundamentalist fringe. During the lead-up to the torching of Antoon's mansion, extremists began doxing Pornhub employees and issuing violent threats online. Shepherding this movement was an outfit called Trafficking Hub, an offshoot of the evangelical Christian organization Exodus Cry, which has well-documented anti-LGBTQ+ and anti-abortion origins. Both groups have dedicated themselves to abolishing Pornhub, whipping their supporters into a punitive frenzy. Burn them to the ground, read a tweet shared on the Trafficking Hub founder's profile 4 days before the arson attack. Under an image of Antoon's new house, another follower wrote, I effing wish that whole mansion will burn to recreate the hell they must burn in. Some sex workers deemed the arson a hate crime. Alana Evans, president of the Adult Performance Artist Guild, classified it, without providing evidence, as a terrorist attack against our industry by anti-porn super-religious people. A longtime erotic industry advocate, Evans told me she'd been receiving messages from zealots warning that they were going to burn my house down like Pornhub. She maintained that the fire was the first time we saw such an extreme act of real violence against our community since the days of Hustler founder Larry Flint being shot by a white supremacist in 1978. I can't even count how many comments I saw from people saying to burn the company or my house down, Antoon said. For a while, it was easy to dismiss the tweets as just people on the internet talking. Then, my house burned down. Antoon, a brawny tech exec with a trim gray beard, is the Syrian-Canadian CEO of Pornhub's parent company, MindGeek. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.